See, you get ready to make a decision. You get ready to live your life in something. You say, what am I going to do today? Is it pretty? That's love. Do something beautiful and kind. Is it unselfish? What's it going to do to the other guy? Is it the right thing to do? That's purity. That's purity. And last of all, am I telling myself the truth? That's honesty. So if it passes all those tests, do it. If it turns out it was wrong, you've got a 10th step. You can clean it up tomorrow. That's what we're looking at. Another great old A.A. Earl H. says, stop doing what you know is wrong and start doing what you know is right. Your life will improve. And that's kind of where we're going with this step. When I got here, this step bothered me a lot because you can see it turned my will. I thought I was going to have to go to China and be a missionary or some damn thing. You know, I didn't want to do this. This didn't look like my kind of deal. I'd already thought about this. But so far, I haven't had to go to China. And what I decided this meant to me, what this step meant to me was, I believe that God's will for me is to live my life the way the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous dictate. To process what happens in my life through those steps. To have the goals and the values that the steps give me. Those are the things that I believe are for me. And so when I made that decision that that's what I'm going to do, I believe that's when I took the third step. And I have tried with varying degrees of success to process my life through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I forget it from time to time, like all of us do. I go back and, you know, I'm running the show again. But it never has worked. And even when it seems to work, oftentimes there's a terrible price to pay in what you do to other people. So as long as we're practicing the four absolutes, as long as we're trying to move for what we think God would have us be, life seems to go along pretty good. Pretty good. We're dealing with spiritual values here. We're letting the material take care of itself. And it seems to do that. At least it has in my life. I think that's what I want to move into step four with. When you make that kind of decision, step four, which says that we made a fearless and searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. The lead into that step in the book says that though our decision, step three, was a vital one, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. We had to get down to causes and conditions. Blocking us from what? Three times, I believe, in that chapter, it refers to not being able to contact a power greater than ourselves. I think self-centeredness blocks us from God. I think it's like C.S. Lewis said, there are two kinds of men. They're the kind that say to God, thy will be done. And there's the kind that God says to them, thy will be done. And I'm a lot better off if I'm trying to do God's will than I am trying to do for him to tell me to try to work it on my own without his help. He's a perfect gentleman. And I was using he in a generic sense, not in a generic sense, but in a expansive sense. I don't know whether God's man, woman, or both. That hadn't become real important to me so far. And if it is to you, I apologize, and I'll try not to do that anymore. Here's where we find our old ideas. First thing they told me about this step was I didn't need it. I didn't need to do this. I'd sent my wife to a psychiatrist because she was obviously kind of hyper critical of drinking. He had wanted to talk to me, and so I reluctantly discussed football and things like that with him. We didn't get too deep, about that deep. And I just really couldn't see any value to rehashing all this old crap that had gone on. All I really wanted to do was quit drinking. I didn't want to change my life a lot. My sponsor didn't do one for quite a while. Another guy in my group hadn't done one for 19 years. That gave me a lot of sauce. He later on said that was the longest 19 years of his life. I tried to suppress all these things. I had things going on in my head that I'd try to suppress. I had favorite resentments. It was like I could sit in my green chair and get my bottle of whiskey, and I could go to my mind, and there was a whole rack of videos that I would play. And I'd plug them in, and I'd play this one, and then I would get to that point where I was offended or harmed in some way, and then I would take over. And I would finish the show about what was going to happen next time. I was going to get him next time and how I was going to get him. If there had been a black button that I could have pressed and gotten rid of all the Al-Anons, there would have been no Al-Anons before about 1974, about a year after I'd been sober. I had all these things going on in my head and never, ever thought about them at all as being negative. You know, did you ever have a good day thinking about a resentment? I didn't. I really never did, but I spent a hell of a lot of my life dwelling on them. I could switch. I could work on Al-Anon for a while, and I'd set it aside, and I'd think of somebody else, and I'd play that, how I was going to kill that guy or what I was going to do to him, or they'd beg for mercy. And if I had enough crowd around me, I'd probably give him mercy. And they'd think, what a wonderful man I was, you know. Socrates says that a life without self-examination is not worth living. And Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, wrote this little thing I want to read you here now that I think is just really pretty special. It says, there's a time in the education of every man when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself for better or worse as his portion, that though the universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his own toil, bestowed on the plot of ground which he was given to till. You're going to have to accept who you are and recognize that's just exactly what you were supposed to have, and do your best in that plot of ground and forget all this other stuff. There's another story. This is written by O. Henry, I believe. I'm not absolutely sure of this, but it was about the old man who was the janitor at the mill. This old fella worked at the mill for many years, and then one day the mill was sold, and we know how that happened is. I guess it was some kind of consolidation or something taking place, but the mill was sold, and the new management came in and said, no one will work here who does not have the ability to read and write. The old man couldn't read or write, so they put him out on the street. He had no way to make a living, so he had a little bit of money, and he started going down to the train station. The train station ran through this little town, and he would buy a carton of cigarettes. And his people were trying to get on the train to go somewhere in a hurry and wouldn't have time to buy their own cigarettes. He'd sell them a pack of cigarettes at a little profit. First thing you know, he had a little box that he was carrying all kinds of brands in. First thing you know, he had a little stand. First thing you know, he opened up a stand down at the next station. And a friend of his complimenting him on his success. He was doing very well. He said, what are you doing with all your money? He said, oh, I put it in a box under my bed. He said, you can't do that. You can't leave your money in your box under your bed. Somebody will steal it. He said, what should I do with it? He said, put it in a bank. He said, how would I do that? He said, I'll show you. So the man took his box of money and went with his friend down to the banker. And the banker was real glad to see anybody with a box of money. Said, have a seat. And he counted the money and filled out a deposit slip and got the signature cards out and handed it to the old man. Said, now, if you just give us your signature right there, we'll be all through and you'll have an account with this bank. And the old man said, oh, I can't read or write. And the banker said, you mean to tell me you've made all this money and you can't read or write? My gosh, he said, think how well off you'd be if you could read or write. He said, oh, if I could read or write, I'd still be a janitor over there at the mill. So we don't know how good we are. We don't know what we got. So we got to look at this thing. We got to process this data, that all these lessons we haven't learned. And what we're going to look for is three things. We're going to look at the three most common forms of self-centeredness. And they will encompass almost every negative event in our lives. And they will have a lesson. Each one of those negative events will have a lesson for us that will keep us from having to repeat that experience again somewhere down the line if we pay attention. We're going to look for resentments. We're going to look for fear. And we're going to look at our relationships. And we start off with the columns. Now, when I started off, I couldn't possibly understand the big book. It talked about those four columns. I didn't know Ms. Smith. I didn't know Ms. Brown. I mean, this was way too complicated for me. And I started collecting four-step guides. I had a stack of them, you know. And it was just almost impossible for me to get my head around this chore that I had. I wrote 40 pages in a spiral notebook and left it in the airport in Indianapolis, Indiana one time. Some guy thinks that some really strange guy passed through Indianapolis. I'm sure of that. I had trouble deciding what kind of paper to use, too, you know. You can't just write this on anything. Loose leaf, no. Yellow pad, you can tear the pages out easy. Spiral notebooks, that's why I've got a spiral notebook. And then, I haven't even talked about what you're going to write it with, what kind of pencil or pen, you know. That's. Finally, I had to do what one of the gals in my group used to say, take pen in hand, put ass in chair, and write. And I did it the way the book said. The first thing it tells us to do is make a grudge list. Is there anybody that came to Alcoholics Anonymous that didn't have some grudges? And is there anybody, I could write pages on what was wrong with the world. And then they make us take off one of those people, institutions, or principles, and put it in column one. And then we go to column two, and we describe exactly the event that caused the bad feeling. You know, you don't learn a damn thing if you hear, who you resent, my wife. What'd she do? She doesn't understand me. Did you learn anything? No, you didn't. But if I go further and say, well, I wanted to play poker with the boys, and in front of all of them, she told me I couldn't play poker. It embarrassed the hell out of me. Well, now you've learned a little something. And so have I. Move over to the third column, they say, why did that bother you? And they give you four choices: ambition, self-esteem, security, or relationships. My wife damaged my self-esteem because she exposed me in front of my clients, showed I was henpecked, a wimp. That involved my relationships as well. So I write those two words down, and I got column three. And I keep doing that, and I go along, and every step of this way, each one of these names, each one of these principles, each one of these institutions, I make those same deals. Maybe with my wife, it was probably more than one event. And possibly. And I make those, I make a list and write them all down, and I write down the, how does that affect me in that third column. And I reach a point down there where I recognize, you know, these people have been controlling my life. My reactions, these folks have been dominating my whole life. And it gives me a prayer to say. And I say a prayer. And then I move over to column number 4. A column which most of us have never, certainly me, had never really looked at. That is, where was I at fault? Now I understand that you can be just as self-centered, feeling like everything is your fault and your name might ought to be on that inventory list, as you can if you think you're a total victim and everybody else is at fault. But most of us never got beyond blame. We didn't get any further over than blame, and you don't learn a damn thing from life until you get past blame. When you get past blame and you get in that fourth column, you begin to understand what I contributed to this situation. Then your education truly begins, and you begin to understand, I began to understand what my life was being dominated by. I finish that and I go to fear. I wasn't afraid. I'm from West Texas. I'm a man. West Texas men know no fear. Did you ever see a John Wayne movie where John Wayne said, I feel a little insecure today? Hell no. But they told me I had to do this damn inventory, and they told me everybody has these three things: resentment, fear, and relationships. And yours are messed up somewhere in there. So I thought, well, you know, probably when I was a little kid, I knew some fear. I'll start back there. Snakes. Do you like snakes? We may have some people here like them. I was taught not to like snakes, because we had rattlesnakes, which are bad snakes, and we had other kind of snakes, which are good snakes. But a 3-year-old kid can't tell the difference between a rattlesnake and a good snake. So I was told, you know, you see that thing on the ground there? That's a snake. He can hurt you. He can hurt you real bad. So you want to stay away from him. Then I was told to go outside and play. Did you ever notice snakes are hard to see in the grass? They blend right in. They don't move until you almost step on them. You're barefooted. Now you're going to walk through that tall grass, barefooted. There's snakes, maybe snakes in there. Could hurt you. Can't see them. You have a feeling in the pit of your stomach. That's fear. Oh, I had that other places. Oh, yeah, I've had that feeling before. And you begin to write the things you fear. People finding out who you are. People talking about you. Afraid you will lose rather than win. Afraid that what you have will be taken away from you. Afraid that people won't like you. Afraid you've said the wrong thing someplace. I found my life was shot full of fear. And I wrote about my fears. I didn't realize how much I was dominated by that which I could not control. That which I could not see until it was too late and I had to encounter it. It all worked just exactly like it did with that snake. And I'm still afraid of snakes. But my grandson had a bull snake, and he was kind enough to let me hold him recently. Now I've got to either be a wimp or hold the damn snake. I held the damn snake. That's what I did. He didn't hurt me. Funny how smooth and slick he was. Different than anything I'd ever thought. But I had to find out about that. Now, I didn't find it necessary to write about my sex relationships. At least initially, I didn't find it necessary. I was married, had two kids, so I knew something about what was going on there. And wasn't messing around any, so I didn't have any point in writing about some of that old stuff. So I didn't write about it. Now I'm going to skip over to the fifth step, where it says that we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. I had a sponsor. I did the four step because I was involved with a bunch of people who were pretty obsessed with this AA program. You know, you could have a hangnail. And they'd say, "You got a hangnail? Yeah. You done a four step?" Now, that wasn't inappropriate because I was the kind of guy that could have a hangnail and I'd look at it and think, you know, that's been there for 3 days. That could be cancer. Then I'm standing in the doctor's office and say, "See how red it is? Is there a cancer of the cuticle that I could be having?" So I did the four step, but didn't really want to do a fifth step. The reason I was reluctant to do the fourth step was because I could read the fifth step. So I went to my sponsor one day, very unusual thing for me to do, and asked him, I said, did you find it necessary to do a four step? He said, "Yeah." I said, "Did you find it necessary to do a fifth step?" He said, "Of course I found it necessary to do a fifth step." I said, "Tell me about that. I'd like to know about doing fifth steps." He said, "Well, I did it with my sponsor." Said, didn't really amount to a lot. Said he, I went to see him. We had an appointment, and he had my little book that I'd written it all down in, and I gave him my little book, and he thumbed it around in a little while. I looked at it a little bit, and he said, "Did you write it all down?" And I said, "Yep, near as I could." And he said, "Well, okay." He said, "Threw it in the trash can." He said, "That's your past. That's all gone. We're going to talk about going forward from here." As a fist step. I've got one of these analytical minds. I thought, you know, if he did that with his sponsor that way, probably the same thing would do. He'd do the same thing with me if I asked him to do my fifth step. So I said, "Would you do a fifth step with me?" And he said, "Yeah." So I took my 2/3 of my fifth step and I went over. And he said, he saw me carry my little book. It was a red book. I got my red book because I was hot item. And I said, "Yes, sir, this is my fourth step." And he said, "Can I see it?" And I said, "Oh, yes, sir." And I handed it to him. I began to look over his desk and see where the trash can was because we're going to need one in just a minute. And he said, "Well, Jerry," he said, "do you want to read this to me or do you want me to read it to you?" And I was just like old Job in the Bible, "That which I feared had come upon me." So I said, "You read it." And then for the next period of time, I stood up on the other side of the desk and would point out, now this is a little overstated right here. Right? We got through with that humiliating experience. And he walked around the desk and put his arms around me and said, "I'm glad you did that. I'm glad you shared that with me. I think you did the best you could." He didn't even say, "You left out a third." He just left it with that. And when I went to my next meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I walked in the door and looked around and thought, "You have paid your dues, cowboy. You belong here." And I started searching out people who had problems, and I asked them, "Have you done your fourth step?" I started a four-step meeting within a month after I had done that. We talked it over, and then the damn fools in that meeting began to ask me, "What did you write about sex relations?" And I said, "Not much." And it was eating me up. So I wrote it in code. It was really a hot item, let me tell you. But you know, there's no area of our life that's more self-centered than our sexuality. We have messed up our sexuality about as much as any species could possibly do it. We've spent days and weeks and years worrying about how we did it, when we did it, how often we did it, who we did it with. Did we have the right equipment? Did we have enough of the right equipment? We told people. We didn't tell people. We hid it. We bragged about it. We did all these things and wondered, did we cause any harm doing that? And our book gives us a series of questions to ask about that. Where have you aroused jealousy? They're in the book. Where have you harmed others with this thing? What should you have done instead? The book recognizes that our sexuality and our is a necessary part of our human existence. And that it's a natural instinct. And we're going to have to deal with it. But the thing we want to do is shape a sane and sober idea for how we're going to do this. And if we mess up somewhere along the line, we don't get drunk over it. We go back and we start over and we finish it up. Now, I had a third of an inventory that I hadn't taken. And here I am conducting a four-step class. Who would you suppose I could ask to do my fifth step? My sponsor had moved off to Jonesboro, Arkansas about that time, and I was in deep trouble. I didn't know who I was going to do it. And then some damn fool walked up one day to me and said, would you be my sponsor? I said, I'll have to call him a sponsor. That's twice I've called him now. You've noticed that? So I called him and I said, You think I could sponsor somebody? And he said, oh, hell yeah. Sure. You can give away what you've been given. Uh-oh. So Tommy and I began to go down the road. And he was I don't know where he came from. He came from Canada is where he came from. We have some Canadians here. And they must be wound pretty tight up there in Canada because he just started going through those damn steps. I mean, it was every day he had moved through to a new place in the book, and he was going pretty fast, and he got through the fourth step, and he said, will you do a fifth step with me? I said, I don't know. I'll call my sponsor. So I called my sponsor. My sponsor said, yeah, go ahead. So we sat down. And I learned the fifth step prayer. Do you know what it is? If you've done more than one fifth step, you know what it is. It's, dear God, please let there be something new. Because we've all done the same damn things. And think we invented sin. We think we invented sex. We failed, you know. And they're boring a lot of times. Just really boring. You kind of doze off, you know. And my sponsor... was doing his fifth step with a guy one time, and the fella had some kind of gastric attack or something, and had to quit doing the fifth step and rush off to the hospital to get some relief. And my sponsor said, you know, he said, for a long time I was afraid I was going to kill somebody with my fourth step. So Tommy did his step with me. Took a lot of time. I looked around at the literature to find out, is there any appropriate way to take a fifth step? I'll save you some time. You just listen. You share when you can, and you listen. I didn't know about sharing that time, though, in the first step, the first time I did it. And Tommy got through with this step, and we went off different directions, and I gave him a hug and told him I was proud of him and glad what he did, and so I called him a day or two later and said, how you feel? And he said, feel fine. Said, kind of feel like I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous now. I said, I feel pretty good. I said, well, you sound a little not as enthusiastic as I'd like here. What's going on? He said, to tell the truth, I feel like you know every damn thing in the world about me, and I don't know that much about you. And what I'd really like is if you do your four step with me. I've never been able to command any real respect from people that I sponsor. They just don't recognize that I'm the guru. But I had that third that I hadn't done. So I went back and did the whole thing with him the next weekend. And Tommy and I have formed a bond over the years that's unlike, was the first one, that not unlike some I've had since, but it was the first, one of the first really close bonds I'd ever had with another man. Always there'd been the macho part interfering with the friendship. And here we were, we both knew each other totally. And I'm a skeptic and a cynic by nature. And I tell this because I feel obligated to do so, because I've been a skeptic and a cynic to many people when they talk about what their spiritual events are. Tommy moved back to Canada after 2 years. And one day, I don't know why, I just felt the need that I need to call him. I had his telephone number, so I called, and I got no answer. I got a busy signal all day long. And I had his sister's telephone number, and I called her, and I said, I can't get hold of Tommy. Is everything all right up there? She said, well, matter of fact, his house just burned to the ground yesterday. Lost everything. A little later, I had a ruptured appendix. And they rushed me to the hospital and had to do an emergency surgery on me. Tommy called me that day. We're very close. We can sit down in the room and in a matter of 10 minutes, we're right back where we started. That's occurred to me over, not in the same degree, but that feeling of knowing people, sharing your life with people, having nothing standing between you and them, is a wonderful thing. It's a great feeling. It's a freeing feeling to be who you are. And you know, one thing about that fifth step is when you've told everybody about your deal, I really think you got to be careful who you select. You should not select a Chinese-speaking taxi driver at the airport. You should talk to someone who knows exactly what you're doing, someone you admire and respect, and tell them about yourself. That's really, I think, very, very important. It gives it a great freedom to have somebody know who you are. And when you're in a meeting, it's your sponsor, and it comes around and they say, have you ever experienced fear? You can't bluff anymore. It's like playing poker, you know, when somebody knows what your hold card is. It forces you to be yourself around other people, which is really what we're trying to do. We're getting into reality, who we really are, what we really think, what we've really experienced. And our lives improve dramatically when we go through that. And we have some promises with the fifth step, if I could find them in about 20 minutes. They follow just after the step. They're not quoted often, but I want to point them out to you. By the way, there is a prayer for fear that's given to us. It's just ask God what He would have us be. What would you have us be? And if you be what you think He would want you to be, you'll know. Most of the time when we talk about God's will, we ask ourselves, what is God's will? We got a pretty good idea of what the right thing is to do. Once we have taken this step, step five, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we've begun to have a spiritual experience. That feeling of the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. The book advises us to go home, look over our fourth and fifth step work, because this is the arc we're going to walk through to freedom, knowing who we are, what we are, and what's motivated us in our lives. We have a good idea of what the causes and conditions of our failures were when we get through with this part of the step. And that's where we need to be when we begin with step six, which we'll do at what time, Lee? 1 o'clock today?
1:30
today? Thank you for your attention. You'll have a nice quiet place here. I'll turn the mic down a little bit so you can sleep without being interrupted, and we'll go forward from here. We're at an interesting point in the steps. From my observation, many, many people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and stall out at various spots. Step three is one of those spots. A lot of people die on step three because they never get beyond, never get into the action. And then people do step four and five and are greatly relieved at what they've found. They go back and read their book and say, I've covered everything. They say their little prayer, and we're going to make amends one of these days. We are. We really are. We're going to straighten this thing out. And then they get to helping other people a little bit. And you can literally, you can stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous at that point, I think. A lot of people, I think, do. But I think there's a deeper level that you can go to if you're willing to continue the work. And the work's just as hard from this point forward as it was from the beginning. This is the fulcrum. This is the place where the steps move from me to those around me. I didn't think I hurt anyone with what I did. That was one of my things. If I'm hurting anybody, I'm hurting myself. Just, by God, leave me alone. And my wife heard that song over and over and over again. You know, it's like a country western almost. But, of course, we did. We hurt people. And so when you finished up those steps and you understand something about what's gone wrong, what your part was in this process, that's the best place you'll ever be in your life to recognize what you've done to other people and why other people have acted the way they have and how you are going to have to deal with those kind of issues as you go forward. The step six says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And the next step, you know, talks about humbly asking him to take away our shortcomings. And that's two paragraphs in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we slide right through those like nothing happened. But I think there's a little more to that. We've come a long way. You know, on this road to reality, we've recognized, first of all, where we were. We're step back to step one. We were powerless. Alcohol was our big problem. We began to recognize in the unmanageability that we were not capable of running life to suit ourselves. If we're observant, we come to believe that there's some power working in Alcoholics Anonymous, God as you understand him, and that it will restore you to sanity. And the sanity, I didn't mention this morning, but I really believe that sanity, that as Bill talks about it, and you'll find it in the tent, over near the 10th step in the big book, is the insanity of taking the first drink. It's not that we were crazy. I was put off by that for a while because I could add two and two. I knew I had added two and two, so I wasn't crazy. So I couldn't handle that. But I read very carefully and found out where I couldn't very well explain why I drank in the face of what I had done before. So that was the issue of sanity which I had to deal with. Another awakening, if you will. I made a commitment.
I made a commitment to try to live my life to some values other than what I want. To try to live my life committed to what I thought a power greater than myself would have me be. What Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the opportunity and duty to pass on what I had been given. And I began to feel good, better about myself. It's hard, you know. It's hard to, when you know you're an alcoholic, and you know at the end of the day you haven't had a drink, and you know that you're trying to turn your life around, and you know that you have tried to help somebody that day, it's hard to feel bad about yourself. You just go to bed and you feel a little better about yourself, and you begin to lighten up. You get on the pink cloud, as they talk about. And you can live on the pink cloud if you want to. It's okay. We shared our findings with somebody else about ourselves, and that gave us a great freedom. We don't have to hide anything anymore. We're okay the way we were, warts and all, as the Al-Anon program is going to talk about. And now we're ready to have these defects of character removed. Wouldn't you like to have them gone? Well, maybe so. Maybe. Maybe. Entirely ready. Do you realize how much ready that is? It's about all the ready there is, you know. I have promised myself for many, many years that I wouldn't do what I'm about to do right now. I'm powerless over this. I have a story that has to do with entirely ready that I should quit telling, but I just, like I say, I'm powerless over this thing. It's about a man who's about, I don't know, he's 50 years old, I guess, had his own business, doing well in life, had everything, seemed like, and he, but there was a lady who worked in his office, an extremely attractive lady. He was drawn to her. He was ready to have a closer relationship with her. But in biblical terms, of him, she would have none. So, on his 50th birthday, he walked into his office. And here she comes right over to him, has a flower in her hand, pins the flower in his lapel, gives him a little kiss on the cheek and a little hug, and said, "Happy birthday, boss." And he said, "Well, thank you, thank you." And she said, "You know, I've known for some time that you wanted a little closer relationship with me." He said, "Well, yes, yes." And she said, "And I've been kind of standoffish." And he said, "Well, it's okay, it's okay." She said, "But would you like to come over to my apartment this afternoon after work and let us get a little better acquainted?" And he was ready. He said, "Yes, yes." So he said, "When should I come?" And she said, "Well, let's make it at 5:30. And he said, "Let's synchronize our watches." So he got at 5:30. He pushed the doorbell. She came to the door, invited him in, took his coat, said, "Would you like to have a drink?" And gave him a drink, set him down on the couch and talked to him a little bit. And she said, "Would you mind terribly if I slipped into something a little more comfortable?" And he said, oh, no, no, please go right ahead." He was ready for her to do that. So she went into her bedroom to slip into something more comfortable, and he decided that he needed to get ready. Suddenly his neck swelled up big, his chest expanded, he ripped off his tie, took off his shoes because he was kind of cramping his feet, and his shirt got to be too tight, and he ripped off his shirt. He called out and said, "Are you ready?" And she said, "Not quite, in a minute." And he got a little more ready. He took off his trousers. He called out again, "Are you ready?" And she said, "I'm ready. Come on in." And when he walked through the bedroom door, he was entirely ready. And his whole office staff said, "Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you." And then he knew humility, like they're talking about in some other steps we've got there. I wasn't, you got to pay attention to these things. The defects of character that you find, the arrogance, the things that we do, some of these things we really kind of like. I had a bad temper. I could go off like that. And I used that temper. I didn't really try to control that temper because I used it to keep people away from me if they got close. And I didn't want them close. I used it to create fear. And I knew what I was doing at times when I did that. And this was not an attractive thing to me, but it was a useful tool for me. I was a trial lawyer. And I was told somebody here today, they affectionately called me the alligator gar in my law office, because I was, man, I went after people. And when I got sober, I began to realize that wasn't going to work for me. I was not going to be able to practice humility. I was not going to be able to practice kindness and tolerance and consideration for people and be that kind of person. And I thought, maybe I got to give up being a trial lawyer. But I decided before I did that, I'd start trying to give up some of these things. And what I found in my case, the first time I did the sixth step, I went home and said, I am entirely ready to give up these defects of character that I found in the fourth and fifth step. But I wasn't dealing with anything specific. I was dealing with the generality. And not too surprisingly, not much happened. Because I had a temper again in a little while, and I had this kind of problem and this kind of problem. And some of these things were useful to me. You know, gossip. Gossip's just my concern for others. Besides, it kind of makes me feel like I'm one of the bunch. You know, I'm kind of, I know. Nobody else knows, but I know. And if I tell you, you'll probably tell me something, you know, that. And I can get caught up in all that kind of stuff. And some of these things, I had the alligator shoe syndrome, I call it. I began to notice that the quality of newcomers coming to my group were not quite as good as when I came in. We have some undesirables in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know that? None of these things are really very useful to you in the long haul. Anything that's harmful to another human being is what we've got to get rid of. And almost any kind of self-centeredness that we have is going to fall within that category, I believe. I think that you have to watch your thoughts. You have to be aware of what they are. Watch your thoughts because they become your actions. Watch your actions because they become your habits. Watch your habits because they become your character. And your character becomes your destiny. So we have to pay close attention to what's going on up here. No one can weed your garden, your mental garden, except yourself. No one knows what's up there except you. So you're charged, we're charged with that job. And resentments, you know, they're bitter, angry thoughts. All of these things center in the mind. Have you ever noticed how much of this has to do with your thoughts? What's a resentment? It's a thought about something what? That happened in the past. It's not happening now. It's a judgment that you're exercising in your mind about an event as you observed it that occurred in the past. And we dredge it up again and again and again. We have fear. That's something that generally hasn't happened. It's something we anticipate may happen. We project it may happen. And it's going to be bad. It's going to be even worse than that. You can't imagine how bad it's going to be. You know, it's like my cuticle cancer. Looks bad. I believe it's redder today than it was yesterday. I'll probably lose that thumb, sure as the world. I need that thumb. How can I hold a golf club if I don't have that thumb? And we just roll it out with projection. Guilt. What I did. what I did. You got to give it up. We got a step over here that's going to deal with what you can do about it. All you can do about it. But it's self-centered. It's judgment of yourself. It has to do with your thoughts, your memories again. We talk about greed. What I need, what I want, what I got to have. I'd be happy if I had it. But it's again, it's me, self-centeredness. I think that all of these things that we have rolling around in our head come from. So all self-centeredness comes from self-centered thought, from thoughts. Fear is going to be tomorrow. It's not happening today. Resentment was yesterday. We judge quickly and often in our minds. So we have to be very careful about what we think about and what's going on up there, because we are the only ones who can really do anything about that. Got a little problem here, though. This is like alcoholism. Only God can do anything about those thoughts. They all feed each other. Did you ever notice that? I've had a bad day at work. It's been a bad day. They haven't appreciated what I do for that bunch down there. I feel sorry for myself. I'm really kind of victimized by this whole damn process. You know, if you're a victim, that's a big business all by itself. Some people make an entire life of it. You got to work at it. You got to recognize that you're ruined forever. It can't get any better. You're ruined from the word go. It's not going to get any better. You got to be able to hold on to that resentment. You cannot give it up. You got to hang on to that resentment, and you got to live it every day. Can't have a hell of a lot of fun. Because victims don't have much fun. So we feel sorry for yourself. Poor little old me. Plum. And these things move around. I have a bad day at work. I'm feeling poor little old me. They didn't appreciate me. Get on the freeway. Get in my lane. Some damn fool gets in there with me. And he offends me. So I get after him. I have a resentment. I'm angry. I get off the freeway. I go to the house. I walk in. My wife hasn't done a damn thing wrong. But I pick out something I don't like. I raise an issue that happened 2 weeks ago about how she did my laundry or something. And I throw it up, you know. And she doesn't react as she should. So I storm out of the kitchen and go back to the bedroom to take off my suit, my armor, you know, my suit clothes. And I think, you know, God, I've overreacted here. I shouldn't have said those things to her. She might divorce me if I keep acting like this. As a matter of fact, if she divorces me, she'd probably get at least half of everything I owe. Now, fear is running through my body like you can't believe, you know. It all just moves around in me. The self-centered just moves from one place to the other. And all of them works that way. Depression. Did you ever start off a day with depression and see anything good that happened that day? No, we collect evidence all day. Of course I feel bad about myself. Look at all this stuff that's happening to me. Fear. Of course I'm afraid. Anybody would be afraid in my circumstances. Anger. Of course I'm angry. Damn right. Look what you've done to me. Look what you're going to do to me next. And we go on and on, and we feed these things, and we live these lives, and they're pitiful lives. My life was pitiful. I loaded myself up with all this self-centered stuff. I hadn't been practicing law a month, and I began to have a big rash on my shoulder. And I didn't have time to go get it looked at by the doctor, because I was working. I had to work. And finally, I scratched it enough. My wife said, "You got to go to the doctor." So one of my young associates' wives worked in a doctor's office, and she said, "Well, if you come in Saturday morning, I'll get the doctor to see. He's going to be here this Saturday morning. I'll get him to look at you this Saturday morning." So I went in to see him. I found an hour I could rush into the hospital. Didn't have to wait. He looked at my shoulder. He said, "That is neurodermatitis." I said, "Really? Is that bad?" He said, that's caused from living in a squirrel cage. You're going someplace as fast as you can go, but you're not moving anywhere. And he said, I'm going to prescribe something for you. And I thought, this is good, you know. What kind of happy pill are you going to give me for this thing, you know? And he wrote on a piece of prescription pad there. He said, it's the name of a book. How to Live 365 Days a Year was the name of this book. It was all designed around living in the reality of today, in the now, appreciating what's happening, stopping to smell the roses, all the good things that we know are good, and none of the bad things that we prosecute. So what I found in my own experience is I have to deal with my defects of character as they crop up. We've got some old ruts that run through our mind, so we can fall back in those ruts very, very easily. And we only get out of those ruts when it's absolutely necessary. There's a story about the little turtle that was in the rut in the road, and it's calling out, help, I can't get out. He tried everything. He couldn't get out of the rut. And a rabbit came along. The rabbit said, can I help you? And he said, help me, I can't get out of the rut. The rabbit said, well, I can't get you out of that. I'll go see if I can find a stick, and maybe we can let you crawl up the stick or something. He said, good, please help me. The rabbit came back in a few minutes, and the turtle's walking down the road. He's out of the rut. He said, What happened? I didn't think you'd get out of the rut. And he said, oh, I heard a wagon coming. And so when he said, knew the wagon was in the rut, he's out of it, you know. That's what we do. I find that I have to monitor these things as they occur. In the last 2 years, I've had two kinds of cancer come up. Every time that's happened to me, I've gone right back into the old ruts, doubting the existence of God, worrying about myself, fearful, angry, all of those things. And it takes me a little while to apply this program to get out of those ruts, till you can walk along and recognize, you know, what the hell? What good is this going to do me? I might as well have a good day. I might as well enjoy myself. I might as well not ruin this day worrying about what's going to happen on the next day. Let's just take them one at a time. And as a friend of mine used to tell me when I was worrying about my lawsuits, some I couldn't win, some I couldn't. He said, he stuttered. He said, well, Jerry, said, there's something you got to know. He said, there's some little lawsuits that you just got to put your feet up on the table and let the good times roll. That's what you got to do, is put your feet up on the table and let the good times roll. He was a good spirit, good influence on my life, a great guy. He couldn't be a trial lawyer, but he loved it, and he helped me be one. So we see these things moving around us, and we deal with them as they come up, the specifics. The other thing that's really a friend of mine pointed out to me, a guy named great AA named Bob White, said there's an implied blessing in this step. It says that we have to have God's help to remove these defects of character, which meant that we couldn't do much about them in the first place. They came to us through life, and we have to discharge them and get rid of them, and we can't do it all by ourselves. So we have to have God's help to do that. And the same power that helped me with drinking, helped me stop drinking, helped me attain sobriety, is available to me on, if it worked on the biggest problem I ever had, why wouldn't it work on one of these? And it does work on one of these. It'll work on this one and any other one you have. There's nothing come down the pike in the years that I've been sober that God and I couldn't handle on a one-day basis. I have always enjoyed those days, and certainly there have been days when I've lost the track, but it's there for me. So you can cut yourself a little slack that you couldn't do any better than you were doing. You were doing the best you could with the light you had. And so is the guy on the other side of the street. He's doing the best he can with the light he's got. And that makes life a little easier also. Step 7 says we humbly ask God to remove these our shortcomings. Humility. Did you ever know a humble trial lawyer? I could just see myself standing in front of the judge or the jury, my head down and scuffing my shoes and saying, golly, I sure do hope you all will be nice to my client. It would help me and my family too. I know I'm not much, but the fact is, that's not humility. That's not humility. That is the kind of humility that being humiliated that I was talking about in the joke I told. We use the word in fact. It comes from humble origins. I didn't want to come from humble origins. That meant you were poor. Well, I was, but I didn't want to talk about it with anybody. He ate humble pie. That means somebody's got the better of you, so they put you down good, you know. I didn't like that either. But there's a book that was written by a man named Emmett Fox. It's called The Sermon on the Mount. The early members of Alcoholics Anonymous used this as sort of a big book for part of their early experience while the book was being written and they were having the experiences necessary for that. And in that book, Emmett Fox is describing the Beatitudes. And one that he describes that I think is particularly appropriate here is, blessed are the poor in spirit. I think that may be humble. Here's what he says about it. One who is powerless, one who has no desire to exercise self-will or control, one who sets aside all old opinions on a wholehearted desire to express God's will, one who is willing to set aside old habits of thought, views, prejudice, and his entire way of life, who is willing to jettison anything and everything that stands in the way of his finding a higher power. Does that sound to you like the first 6 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? That's where we are. When we are practicing, when we've dealt with a problem, we've focused on it, and we know where we are, we know what we're doing, we put the principles of the first steps of Alcoholics Anonymous into play, and then we humbly ask God for his will in that circumstance. And I think that is the 7th step. I think that works for me. So then we move on to our favorite steps, which are step 8 and 9. We all just love these steps. They're made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Damned if I would. Maybe one or two that I owed money or something that I could say I'm sorry about, but, you know, didn't talk about much about saying you're sorry. The list, the book says, came from the 4th step. And most of mine probably did. I don't think I accumulated them at that particular time, and my sponsor wasn't one of those people who wrote them down. But lots of sponsors do help you find what your amends are, who they ought to be given to. The purpose is to find our faults, to decide on the amends that we're to make, and to improve our relationships with all men. That's what Bill says in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. That no field of investigation could yield more satisfying results. What were your relationships like when you came to Alcoholics Anonymous? Mine were not too slick. I was either looking up to somebody, currying their favor, or I was looking down on somebody, critical of their life. There was not much equality and mutuality in my relationships. And so I had to get overcome some old ideas. The one I told you about earlier, I only hurt myself by my conduct. Another is that they hurt me, therefore I'm entitled to hurt them. Or they hurt me more than I hurt them. I will if they will. There's not much you can read in the steps that say anything about any of those things I've just recited. It's not a quantitative thing. My old buddy Bob White used to say, if you were 1% at fault, you owe an amend. Didn't make a damn if the other guy's 99% at fault. Your job, Mr. Jones, is to clean your side of the street. You want to be able to walk into any room in the world and sit down next to any other human being and feel perfectly comfortable and at ease. Doesn't mean you got to like them. Doesn't believe you got to admire them. But it's okay to sit there because you have done your part to clean up what's going on with you. And that's a major, major job. But it is, I don't hold myself up to much claim.